Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Hezbollah rockets rained down on northern Israel today, hitting Haifa as well as four other towns. Earlier today, Israel struck a Lebanese army base outside Beirut. And right now, hundreds of Europeans and Americans are being evacuated from Lebanon by ship, plane, and helicopter. Israel has said its actions could last several weeks and involve a massive ground offensive. Well, joining us from Haifa is New York Times correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, there have also been reports of Lebanon's huge missile stock, upwards of 10,000 missiles. They've only begun, one analyst says, to use those missiles. So how are people feeling in Haifa, first of all?
Well, I think there's a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. Haifa was a city that had never been hit. Hezbollah has been firing rockets on northern Israel on and off for over 20 years. And until a few days ago, Haifa had never been hit. So the city has emptied out to a great extent. It's been hit several days in a row now, and people are taking the threat very, very seriously here.
Well, what happened to the thoughts expressed yesterday that there might be some international diplomacy that could bring about a ceasefire? Prime Minister Olmert said today that the offensive into Lebanon might take several weeks, might include ground troops. So that doesn't seem to jive with possible, you know, ceasefire.
Yeah, my own sense is that the diplomacy is starting to make some efforts, but I don't see it happening quickly. And I think perhaps the strongest sign of this is the fact that the United States is evacuating American citizens from Lebanon. The United States and Israel are very close allies and are in very close contact here. I'm sure that if the Israelis told the United States that there was some sort of likely ceasefire coming or a possibility, that we wouldn't see this major evacuation effort by the United States. So I see that as very, very telling, that the fact that the U.S. is going ahead with this evacuation of American citizens from Lebanon.
Well, we understand that one of Israel's ministers has also said that they might consider an international force as a way of backing up a Lebanese army. But what has happened with that offer? Russia, for instance, offered to be part of an international force in sort of a buffer zone. What has happened with that?
I think it's very premature right now. There are ideas being kicked around, but I don't see anything concrete really emerging right now. As you mentioned, that is one idea. Although I'd have to say the Israelis, I think in general, would be pretty skeptical of that. I mean, there has been a UN force in southern Lebanon for upwards of 20 years. It's been very ineffectual. The Israelis treat it really as a joke. And as we've seen, it's really been a non-factor in the latest crisis.
And Greg, could you clarify something for us? Has any country outside of Lebanon called for a ceasefire on the part of Israel? And if not, I mean, we know that leaders have said that they felt that perhaps Israel's reaction was too strong. But has anyone directly called for a ceasefire? And if not, is Israel being given the tacit message from the world body to go in and take out Hezbollah?
I mean, the Arab countries have certainly called for an end to the Israeli attacks. The Arab League met over the weekend and was seeking that. Israel, of course, just ignored that call. And I think, again, the key here is to see what the U.S. Administration says. And they are not putting very little pressure on Israel now. They're asking Israel to use restraint, avoid the civilian casualties and civilian infrastructure, but they're certainly not sending the message, at least publicly, that they want Israel to stop its actions.
And
in fact,
Israel is contending that its offensive is in some ways helping the Lebanese government, rooting out Hezbollah in the region. But we want to ask you quickly in the minute that we have about Gaza. The recent fighting in Israel on the border with Lebanon has taken the world's attention off the fighting with Palestinians in Gaza to retrieve the soldier who was captured there. Is there still fighting going on there?
Yes, it has been at a lower level, though. Israel is still carrying out airstrikes. It did move some troops into and back Gaza for a second time. So there is still shooting going on there, but it has been at a reduced level since the northern border, Israel's northern border with Lebanon, heated up.
Greg Myrie, correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Haifa, still being shelled today by missiles from Lebanon. Greg, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We want to spend a few minutes today on coal. If you think coal is the fuel of the past, think again. In fact, you're probably using it right now. Journalist Jeff Goodall says that the average American consumes 20 pounds of coal every day just to keep your lights on. And as one industry spokesman asked him, did you know that it takes more electricity to charge a Palm Pilot than to run a refrigerator? What happens when you turn on your computer or your iPod? Or when you order a book from Amazon over the internet, did you know you burn over 3 pounds of coal? Or, as Jeff claims in his new book, our shiny white iPod economy is propped up by dirty black rocks. His book is called Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future, and Jeff Goodall joins us from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And put this into some perspective for us, because you point out that Americans, for the most part, unless you live in Appalachia or West Virginia, you don't smell or feel, you know, on your skin that coal is burning, as, let's say, the Chinese do, because it's so sooty in China, and China's so dependent on coal. But you say that per capita consumption of coal in the U.S. is actually 3 times higher than China?
It's true. I mean, it's hard to believe, but, you know, we do a good job of keeping it out of the public eye, and that is not altogether deliberate, but we don't use coal anymore like we used to power railroads, for heating in our home, and, you know, in the basement we used to have coal bins and stuff like that. Now it's burned almost exclusively in these really enormous power plants that are around the United States that are kind of out of sight and out of mind, and because it's not a tangible part of our daily life anymore, like it still is in China, we forget how crucial it is.
Right. Well, and by the way, what's the problem with that Americans use it? In reading your book, and by the way, when I read, I highlight, and it got ridiculous in your book. I kept highlighting every single line and this interesting fact in it. But critics could cherry pick from your book the way they would from, like, a bad movie review to make a pro-coal argument because, as you write, coal has virtues. It can be shipped by boats or railroad. It's easy to store. It's easy to burn. It's plentiful. It's abundant in the U.S. It's the cheapest way to generate electricity. In fact, the U.S. has 25% of the world's recoverable coal reserves. The Middle East has the oil, but the U.S. has coal. So those sound like really good things. What are the problems?
Well, those are good things, and my book is not, you know, the argument of my book is not that we should end coal burning in America, but that we need to burn it in a more intelligent way and in a less destructive way. The big problem with the coal, and well, there's two problems. One of the big problems is that coal is an enormously politically influential. So there have been a lot of sort of regulatory rollbacks and things that have allowed the coal industry to, you know, essentially get away with things that are enormously destructive, such as keeping the burning of dirty coal plants going and a kind of mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia and Appalachia.
Let's explain that mountaintop removal, where you literally, instead of going in to dig for the coal, you just dig away the mountain until it's gone and you find the coal.
That was one of the stunning things when I first started reporting this book in 2001. I went to West Virginia for the New York Times Magazine, and I'd never seen any of these enormous mountaintop removal mines, which are essentially strip mines kind of on steroids. They use ammonium nitrate explosives to blow up the mountain, and they dump the debris of the mountain into nearby streams and rivers and then get the coal out that way rather than tunneling underground the way they used to.
Well, I'm going to go through your other items from the negative list of coal's impact. You say, yes, it might have been plentiful at one time, but now the coal that's available is harder to find, it's deeper, it's harder to get at, and it's also in places where, you know, what are you going to do with the houses that are sitting on top of it?
Coal boosters, including President Bush, often like to claim that we're the Saudi Arabia of coal, and we do have lots of coal, but unfortunately it's not sitting in a big shiny pile in the middle of the country. It's deeply buried under national parks, under cities, under farms, and we can get it, and it's there if we need it, but it's going to be enormously destructive to get it out of the ground, and that's never brought up in these commercials about how much coal we have.
And it's dangerous. It's a dangerous profession, as all Americans have been reminded in the last few years with the coal mining accidents. But you point out that as tragic as those accidents have been, and you met with many of the workers, more people die from breathing it.
The underground coal miner that we think of, these men who are trapped underground and that is the sort of archetypal coal miner with the dirty face and the lantern hat, is really a dying breed. The most coal production in America today, and an increasing amount in the future, is from these giant strip mines. And those kinds of operation are not very man-intensive. They're mostly, you know, big, heavy equipment, enormous shovels and dump trucks and things. The mining deaths are important and covered large, you know, in a big way by the media because it's very dramatic and because it harks back to our industrial heritage. And there's something very profound about these men underground being trapped. But when you look at it in a numbers sense, you know, it's really the air pollution that is really, as far as mortality, the most dangerous thing about coal. The American Lung Association says that coal-fired power plants, pollution from coal-fired power plants, causes the premature death of 24,000 people a year, which is, you know, an enormous number.
You say it wasn't supposed to be this way. Coal was supposed to give way to nuclear energy, to gas. What happened?
It's essentially a kind of perfect storm of things that came together to give birth to this coal boom that we're seeing right now. And, you know, part of it is the rise of natural gas prices that happened in recent years. Natural gas has essentially tripled in price, making natural gas, which is the main competitor to coal for electric power generation, much more expensive. Mm-hmm. Renewable energy like wind and solar are not ready for, you know, prime time in a big way yet. Nuclear is out of the picture. It may be coming back in some slow and distant way, but it's, for the moment, out of the picture.
Because people are resisting building new nuclear plants.
And then you had a political situation that has really favored coal. I mean, the Bush administration since the 2000 election has made no secret of the fact that it is a good friend of the coal industry, and they've rolled back a number of regulations that have made it easier and more profitable for the coal industry to thrive. And so they've taken advantage of that.
And you illustrate that cozy relationship by pointing out how in the Clinton administration, the Mine Safety and Health Administration was run by a safety expert. He was no friend of coal. But President Bush gave the job to a former coal company executive who lobbied for less restrictive rules against the coal dust that causes black lung disease. And the head of the Labor Department, Elaine Chao, is married to a coal booster, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. In fact, you write, one industry executive told an inspector, and I'm paraphrasing here, Mitch McConnell likes me, and the last I checked, he was sleeping with your boss. We are speaking with Jeff Goodell. His new book is Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. He writes, if you use a computer, if you turn on a light, you're complicit in Big Coal's role. And by the way, another reason he says the rise of Big Coal happened is the fall of coal's nemesis, Enron. So all sorts of things in this book. When we come back, there's cleaner ways to burn coal, but companies aren't switching because it's too expensive. We'll find out about that. Also, who's going to work in the coal mines in the future? Jeff says there are now more florists than coal miners in the U.S. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. About coal continues with Jeff Goodell. His new fascinating book is Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. And Jeff, you say that even the industries that use coal know that one day they're going to have to pay a fine of sorts for the emissions, the pollution they create by burning coal. And that's, by the way, one of your suggestions, mandating fines for carbon dioxide emissions. But you say you don't think the coal mining industry should be shut down. What do you think should happen?
What should happen is that this industry should be reined in. I think that it's gotten away with a lot of stuff in recent years. And, you know, I think that we as Americans need to think about what kind of price we really want to pay for our energy. Coal is often touted as a cheap source of energy. But when you look at the true costs, from air pollution deaths, from the destruction of Appalachia, from these big mines, when you look at miners who were killed underground, and most important, if you take global warming at all seriously, and you look at this big build-out of coal plants, you know, it's anything but cheap. power, and it's a way of sort of exploiting the present and mortgaging our future, this new build out in coal.
Talk about the connection between coal mining and global warming.
The connection between coal burning and global warming is profound. You can, in a matter of speaking, in fact, some climate scientists go so far as to say, you know, the problem with carbon dioxide emissions, which are the main greenhouse gas, is a problem of coal. Coal is by far the most carbon intensive of all fossil fuels. And these giant coal plants that burn so much coal and generate so much electricity are also huge sources of carbon dioxide emissions. To give you an example, one of the coal plants that I looked into, a new coal plant that's going up in Illinois, will emit roughly twice as much carbon dioxide as every car built by Ford Motor Company this year. So these are enormous sources of CO2. And if you're going to begin to rein in CO2, then coal is the first thing that you have to deal with.
If I've seen any criticism of the book, and it's rare and it's small, it is that you sound as perhaps unenthusiastic about other sources of fuel, wind energy, solar energy, as the coal companies would like Americans to be. Do you think that they are way too far in the future?
No, I'm not unenthusiastic about other kinds of energy. I'm unenthusiastic about predicting the future. People will always say, well, if we're not going to burn coal, you know, we'll have to, you know, cover the entire state of South Dakota with solar panels or something like that. And mm-hmm. I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I worked in the computer industry. I worked at Apple, and I saw how technology moves in unpredictable ways. And, you know, it's impossible to say, you know, where our energy future is going to take us. Mm. What it is possible to do is make judgments about what we care about. Do we care about preserving the Appalachian Mountains, or are we willing to write them off for a sacrifice for cheap energy? Do we care about our climate? Do we want a stable climate? If we do, we need to make decisions about, you know, carbon dioxide emissions. And then once we make those decisions and set out essentially a kind of playing field, then I'm all for letting the entrepreneurs and the businessmen and the people who are good at this, the engineers, figure out how to do it. And I think that once you get a playing field that is fair and reflects the values that we really want to underscore, then there's going to be a kind of flowering and a kind of great unleashing of entrepreneurial spirit.
But you and others have said there's not enough time. I mean, this is, many people feel this is critical and has to be done today, change in coal, in order not to impact the global warming in the way you outline.
It doesn't have to be done today in the sense that we need to shut down every coal plant. But I think that we need to, you know, get on with taking this seriously and moving seriously in the direction of progress. I mean, one of the problems is we have 140 or so new coal plants planned in America or permitted, and only a handful, maybe five or six, use a kind of coal gasification technology which will allow the carbon dioxide to be someday captured and sequestered underground so it doesn't go into the atmosphere. So that means that the other 130 or so power plants are just continuing with business as usual. And, you know, from a climate point of view, letting that go forward is a disaster.
You know, coal as a you know, as the fuel of the future also pulls up short, I would think, when you think of it replacing oil. Is it possible to run all of the engines that run on oil with coal?
No. I'm glad you brought that up, because the centerpiece of the sort of argument to use more coal is because of the war in the Middle East and energy independence. But in fact, as we talked about earlier, coal is almost entirely used for electricity generation today. And of course, oil is not used for electricity, entirely used for transportation. And it is possible to build a kind of coal refinery that can liquefy coal into diesel fuel. That's the one that they can do gasoline, but mostly diesel right now. So it's possible to do, but it's a kind of gold-plated Cadillac solution to America's problem with oil addiction in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. These plants are very expensive. They take a long time to build, and most importantly, they're a big step backwards when it comes to dealing with carbon dioxide emissions and greenhouse gases, because they emit roughly twice as much of these gases as a conventional refinery.
Well, Jeff Goodell, you say big coal should be reined in. One critic sort of characterized your solution as a kind of national psychotherapy program. But your words were to change Americans' thinking, to make the invisible visible. What does that mean? What would you like to see?
Well, I think one of the problems with the way we use electricity in America, and I was part of this prior to working on this book, is that, you know, we think that electricity as this sort of golden juice that flows down from a bowl in the sky or something, and we have no real sense of the connection of where it comes from and what it really costs us. And I think that if we go blindly into this coal boom, I think that we are going to look back in 10 years and say, oh my God, what have we done? I mean, look what happened to Appalachia. There used to be mountains there. They're gone. You know, look at these dead coal miners. And most importantly, we have a climate that's out of control. And we did all of this in order to get cheap power to run our iPods. That was not a good deal.
Jeff Goodell's new book is Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Futures. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, today and tomorrow on Here and Now, South Africa on film and in novel form. Coming up, the Academy Award-winning film Tsotsi out on DVD. We'll speak with the film's director. And tomorrow, we speak with Pamela Geen, who wrote the play The Syringa Tree, and she's now turned that into a novel. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from When then Harvard President Lawrence Summers suggested that women could be innately inferior in the fields of math and science, he set off a firestorm. Some academics rallied behind Summers, but Summers has since left Harvard, and now a Stanford University scientist has come forward to dispute Summers' thinking. Professor Ben Barries of Stanford School of Medicine says he knows that women in science are discriminated against because he once was one. Ben Barries was born Barbara Barries. As Barbara, he attended MIT. Around 11 years ago, at the age of 40, Barries began treatment to become a man. Professor Barries wrote about his experiences in a recent article in the magazine Nature. Professor Barries has his own critics. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker says Barries reduced science to Oprah and that he and Summers don't discount personal experience when they count innate ability. Well, we want to talk to Professor Barries about his personal experience. He joins us on the line from California. Professor, welcome.
Hi.
Can you tell us, first of all, about growing up a woman in the science field? How did you feel about science? Did you feel, when you were younger, were you aware of discrimination?
No, I was not. I think many young people are not, very fortunately, because it's very discouraging to think that you might be treated differently because of your gender.
And then you changed genders. How did you have a realization then, when you were a man in the field of science, that you were being treated differently?
Well, first of all, of course, one doesn't change sex because one thinks one will accrue some advantage to that. I had already been tenured at the time I changed sex, so there was no further any professional advantage. This is something that comes from deep feelings about gender. But having changed sex and then now living as a male scientist, I certainly had experiences that made me realize the way men and women were treated differently. For one thing, men were much more willing to tell me what they really thought about women. I had one a senior surgeon here, a man, neurosurgeon, tell me that he'd never met a woman surgeon that was remotely as good as a man, for instance, which of course is nonsense. If that were true, morbidity, mortality statistics would show a difference, and they don't. The first time I gave a talk, actually, after I changed sex, was at MIT at a Whitehead symposium, and I found out after my talk that one colleague had said to another colleague, gee, that Ben Barries gave a great talk today. His work is so much better than his sister's.
His sister's, of course, would have been Barbara, would have been you as a woman.
Yeah.
And we understand that as a male scientist, you also started to look back at your life as a female scientist, especially after Lawrence Summers' comments.
Yes, it was having that his comments that really made me reflect on the advancement of women, which of course is what he was talking about, and realizing that it was the view, you know, the view that women were less good, and that presumption that is the reason why women are being held back. And it certainly made me open my eyes and made me think about events in my life. When I was an undergrad at MIT, I was the only person in a large class, largely men, greater than 90% men, to solve a math problem. And I was told, the professor told the class when he turned back the exam, that nobody had solved that problem. And so I went up to him afterwards, and I pointed out on my exam that I had solved the problem, and he looked at me with this sort of sneer and said, oh, well, your boyfriend must have done that for you.
Hmm. Well, you now write in Nature that the Larry Summers principle, as you refer to it, this idea that women lack the same intrinsic aptitude, his words, for science and math as men.
He didn't say that. He said that he'd given the matter some serious thought, and that in his best guess, that was a contributing factor. He did mention other factors, but he thought that that factor, for instance, was more important than bias. He did later recant and admit that bias was a more important factor than he had originally given credit. But to my disappointment, I never heard any public apology that he changed his mind about the innate inaptitude of women.
Well, Professor, you offer an alternative theory, one for which you give scientific evidence. You say that women aren't advancing because of discrimination. Now, we want to ask, is your argument based mostly on that scientific evidence or on your personal experience?
Absolutely. Although in the article I did convey a few anecdotes of personal events that happened to me, but the point of my commentary was to review the scientific studies that have investigated the matter. And I have many references to reviews and studies that not only show that there are not significant cognitive differences between men and women, what few cognitive differences have been measured are rapidly going away as social factors change or have been shown to be attributed to social factors. Moreover, there are innate differences between men and women, but where it's been looked at, studies show that those particular innate differences are not relevant to the reason why women are not advancing. And in addition, I think the most important point is that there's overwhelming evidence and contrast that there's profound degrees of bias that greatly impair women's abilities to get jobs, to win grants, and so forth.
Well, Professor, we know you've already started to try to change the way society views women in science. You were one of many petitioning the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, to change the review process for awards. In the past, the NIH panel, we understand, was largely men, and they chose men to win awards.
That's right, and it's very clear that the way one designs competitions for grants and for jobs can totally influence whether any women or minorities can win these awards.
So what's happened now?
To NIH's credit, they immediately revamped the process to make it much more fair. They instituted a diverse judging panel, and they also reminded people at every step along the way that they valued diversity in terms of the outcome. And furthermore, they created a nomination process, a self-nomination process, so that there were no barriers and that the very best people could get into the competition regardless of race, gender, or religion.
Professor Barris, your story is fascinating. Before we let you go, has anyone ever said to you, oh, yeah, Barbara Barris was a great scientist, but when you think about it, she wasn't really a woman. She was you, a man trapped in a woman's body. You know, so it doesn't go to the argument that women are as good scientists as men.
Yes, I would not include myself as a datum point in that argument. I just can say that having lived life as a woman and as a man, I've been very aware of the social factors that affect talented women.
You've had a chance to see both. And just one last question. You've noticed that there have been other changes since you have gone through this procedure. Mm-hmm. And as a scientist, you have a unique point of view on yourself as a study. For instance, you lost the ability to cry?
Yes, I was very surprised by that. I always thought that when you're a little boy, that's something that's beaten out of you. But when I started taking testosterone, very quickly, I nearly lost the ability to cry. I mean, I can cry a tear or two under severe duress, but, you know, it's not the, you know, flood of tears that comes when something slightly sad happens.
Mm. And there was something about driving as well?
I had some testing to look at my spatial abilities before and after testosterone, and there did seem to me to be a little bit of an improvement in those. But I make the comment in my commentary that I still get lost every time I get in the car.
It's funny, looking at those other things, the ability to cry, the ability to ask for directions, whatever, it does go back to that argument that men have some innate talents or abilities,
yes,
and women have some innate talents and abilities.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, and I would certainly never doubt and never meant to say, and I certainly say clearly in my commentary, there are without doubt innate differences between men and women. I simply point out in my commentary that those innate differences are not relevant to the advancement of women in science.
Well, Professor Ben Barris of Stanford University School of Medicine, thanks so much for speaking to us about your experiences being a scientist, both as a man and a woman.
A pleasure.
Oh, and by the way, we want to note the man who prompted Professor Barris's introspection, Lawrence Summers of Harvard University, has stepped down as Harvard's president, as we said, but he is still affiliated with the university. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the ongoing violence in the Middle East is setting crude oil prices to near record levels. The price is hovering around $76 a barrel, just short of the all-time high of $78 a barrel, which was achieved last week at the gas pump. And that translates into a nationwide average of $2.98 a gallon. How long will the prices continue to soar, and how high will the cost for a gallon of gas get? For some answers, we turn to Vahan Janjigian, vice president of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. And Vahan, the fighting in the Middle East, as you well know, is between Israel and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Neither country has a direct effect on oil supplies. So explain again why oil prices are shooting up.
Yeah, that's right. Neither Israel nor Lebanon exports any oil. But traders are nervous because there's always the possibility that the conflict will spread to other countries in the region. And most notably, we've already heard President Ahmadinejad of Iran threaten retaliation if Israel were to attack Syria.
Iran, of course, backing the Hezbollah militants.
Correct, yes. And the oil traders are concerned that one form of retaliation might be to restrict the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz, which is where most of the Persian Gulf oil comes from. It goes through the straits, which separates the Persian Gulf from the Arabian Sea.
Do you think Iran would actually do that, and how significant would that be?
I think there's a possibility that Iran might do something like that for a short period of time, but of course they would be hurting themselves if they did. If they were to restrict the flow of oil or to close the straits for even a short period of time, we could see the price of oil spike up to about $100 per barrel. But of course, when Iran sees the price that high, it's going to realize that it's in its benefit to start selling oil again.
Right.
After all, Iran has been the biggest beneficiary, or one of the biggest beneficiaries, from this price rise. Just a few years ago, oil was selling for only around $20 or $30 a barrel. And now Iran is really reaping in the rewards of this price hike.
So lose that. But boy, $100 a barrel, you've got our attention. How would that translate at the pump?
Well, you know, at $100 per barrel, we would probably be looking at somewhere between $4 and $5 per gallon.
Mm. So you say the market is, you know, nervous right now. So, you know, they're holding on to the oil. But, you know, consumers might be wondering, well, there's been no interruption yet. Why am I paying more? When does it reach, you know, price gouging?
Well, you know, I really don't believe there is any price gouging. There's been no evidence of price gouging.
Oh, no, I'm saying, how long does it go? You know, in other words, when do they loosen up if, for instance, the fighting goes on for weeks and there's no cutoff of oil from Iran?
Well, you know, we've never had, at least in recent times, we've never really had a shortage. But, you know, let me point out that the conflict in the Middle East is not the only reason why oil prices have gone up. In
mm-hmm.
fact, you could argue that it has had very little impact on the price of oil because we were already around $75 per barrel before the conflict began. No, what is also going on is that we're in a situation where supply is very tight. We don't have any shortages, but the world is already producing almost as much oil as it possibly can, and we're consuming almost everything we produce. So there's virtually no slack in the system, and speculators and traders are very concerned that something might go wrong somewhere that would result in a shortage. So. You know, we don't have any fear of any immediate shortages, but if something were to happen, such as the closure of the Straits of Hormuz or political unrest in Venezuela or Nigeria or someplace like that, we could be facing a shortage. And it's because of these possibilities that we've seen the price rise.
And we will be cooked in that case. Well, in the minute we have, you said something very interesting, that what people are doing to respond to the rising cost of oil is they're buying small second cars. They're keeping their SUVs and their minivans, but buying hybrids to drive the longer distances and taking care of it that way.
Yeah, not just hybrids. I mean, we know for a fact that hybrid sales are up. I mean, a Toyota Prius is a very popular car and a fast-selling car. But people are also buying smaller cars. Many people who have two SUVs or a minivan and an SUV have gotten rid of one of them and bought a smaller sedan that gets much better fuel economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, people are taking measures, and it's all because of the price.
Vahan Janjigian, Vice President of the Forbes Investor Advisory Institute. Thanks, as always, for checking in.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Over the next 2 days, we're looking at two stories out of South Africa. We begin with the winner of this year's Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, Tsotsi, which is out on DVD today. Tsotsi is shorthand for thug in South Africa's townships, where a word like decency can be hard to define.
Decency. Atingboy. D-E-C-E-N-C-Y. Decency. Oh, grand.
You mean that?
Decency means making a decent living, Sonny.
Respect, man, for yourself.
Tsotsi is also the name of the fictional lead of the film, a murderous shantytown teenager seemingly devoid of decency. But when he shoots a middle-class black woman, steals her car, and finds her infant son in the back seat, his own sense of right and wrong begins to awaken. Tsotsi was inspired by South African screenwriter Athol Fugard's novel of the same name, written in the 50s during apartheid. Writer-director Gavin Hood, a white South African, has set his film in modern-day South Africa. And as he told us when the film was first released, he was inspired to make it when his own parents were robbed at gunpoint.
There were three young kids with guns kind of in their faces saying, give us the cell phone, give us the wallets. And one of them tore my mother's necklace from her neck and she was kind of bleeding a bit. And my mom was trying to engage in a conversation with this young man and sort of saying, you know, in a somewhat naive and sincere way, sort of wanting to talk and say, you don't want to be doing this, darling. You know, what would your mum say? And where is your mother? And trying to have some engagement. And afterwards, I remember sitting with her and saying, Mom, what were you thinking? You know, you can get shot. Just give the kids what they want. And she was upset because she said, but Gavin, he was just a child. Hmm. Now, as I say, that is an extremely naive point of view, but it also gets one thinking because you feel very angry when something like this happens to your mother. And at the same time, I actually knew kids like these kids because I'd worked in the shantytowns and the townships when I first came out of film school for about 3 years. And most kids, behind the mask of anger or whatever it is that they use to protect themselves and keep themselves tough in these environments, when you get them one-on-one, they are, as my mother said, just kids like anyone else.
And you also write that when you read Athol Fugard's extraordinary novel, Tsotsi, you realize that you wanted to tell a story about a young kid who waves a gun but really needs to engage in a conversation about his mother. And we learned during your film that there's a backstory about this young character's mother seemed to have died from AIDS.
Yes. I mean, one of the big crises we do face is the HIV and AIDS crisis. There are, you know, thousands of young orphans who are struggling to raise themselves. I hasten to say there are also thousands of these young orphans who are in homes, and it's a very frightening thing sometimes as a South African filmmaker. You feel your film has to be completely definitive because we don't get to make a lot of films, and I think a lot of our directors feel this pressure to somehow be definitive of the whole country, which of course you can't be. So this is dealing with a certain incident in the particular shantytown, but yes, there are kids trying to raise themselves and take care of themselves without parental support or much social support.
And reviewers have pointed out that in that way this film could be about these sort of shantytown orphaned kids anywhere in the world who are, you know, sort of forming these little motley gangs. But
yes.
What is the challenge for you, though? Because we don't want to give the impression that you're saying, oh, these murderous kids who, I mean, he has no morals, Tsotsi. He participates in brutal robberies and murders and seems to have no conscience or heart. Mm-hmm. You're not romanticizing him.
I hope not. No, absolutely. And we didn't want to sort of make a sugary... apologetic, kind of white liberal thing. For me, what this became about was just a story about an angry young man who, at a certain point, an event happens, which is, of course, when he drives away with the baby, that just cracks him open very slightly. But it doesn't suddenly change him and he's all soppy and fine. It's tremendous resistance to looking inward for any of us. It's that sort of moment of the examined life. So at the beginning of the film, we didn't want to apologize for him. And there was some debate about that. I mean, do you start to say, oh, you know, if we want the audience to sympathize him, let's not make him too bad. Let's make him a pickpocket. You know, that won't be so bad. But that avoids the real challenge thematically of what this film is about, which is issues of forgiveness and redemption and personal responsibility and our own recognition of our own privilege versus someone else's lack of privilege, and yet what they do is so bad that we don't forgive it, and nor should we. These complicated ideas, it seemed to me, are best explored if you don't pull back from it.
But how much to forgive? Again, Sotsi carries out a brutal home burglary. He carjacks and shoots a well-off black mother, takes her child. It's stomach-turning. But it's also heartbreaking to see him want to mother that child the way he wasn't.
Exactly.
I think
that's a perfectly valid and important question. I mean, I think, you know, we have responses at the end of the film that range from people who feel that he should go to prison for the rest of his life, and we have other people who want to take him home and adopt him and give him tea and cookies. And frankly, I don't think either is valid. There's some sort of middle ground.
We know that you used largely local actors. You had them speak in Xochitl, if I get that right?
Xochitl, yeah.
Which is the language of the streets of Soweto. Why was it important for you to use these locals? And then the extraordinary young actor who plays Sotsi.
Yes, I mean, Presley Chweneyagae was, a gem, and I don't know that I'd be sitting here today without that central performance, indeed without all the performance. But I think that was one of the reasons I wanted to do the film in the local language, because so often it's difficult enough to access a really rooted honest emotion without being melodramatic or overplaying it. And when you're having to work in a language that is not your own, like English, I mean, English is my first language, but it's not Presley's first language. Mm-hmm. His first language is Tswana. There's a barrier. There's enough things in the way of accessing emotion. It's difficult enough. Why put that barrier in the way? But more importantly, I really do feel that one of the things that a foreign audience enjoys about this film, I hope, is that you immerse yourself in another world and the sound of that language. I mean, they don't speak. There's not a lot of dialogue because I knew it would be subtitled. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to keep the dialogue to a minimum. So hopefully it doesn't get in your way at all. It goes by and you read it pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But that oral, if that's the right word, audio experience is as exciting in the sense that you're going into another world as the visual experience.
Why bona re pipe? Ego dimo mo lefting.
Ya ga bon.
Nele minaise.
Ente bona so tlala fa. O funa ka visa le ngotsi tla tsala ke la tala.
The actors are authentic. And so is the music. I just want to touch on the Kwaito music, which sort of drives forward the whole film as well. Let's listen to just a little bit. This is the track that kicks off the action in the film. How important was that sound?
Well, I'm glad you wrote that, because the music was a wonderful element. I remember when Peter Kudakovsky, our producer, came to South Africa and heard that music, it gave him tremendous cock. He said, now I can see this film having a sort of entertainment drive. And he was absolutely right in the sense that the music is great for two reasons. One, it really is the music that comes from these places. It really comes out of these townships. So you don't have to hunt around going, what music should we use? Here it is. Secondly, it gives the film a tremendous energy. And thirdly, that energy then allows the moments of stillness, which are really where the shifts in that character happen, in the moments of silence, to feel earned. That counterpoint of this driving music, and then suddenly your silences feel earned, and that the audience is ready to engage in a more emotional way.
Writer-director Gavin Hood. His film Sotsi won this year's Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. It's now out on DVD. To hear an extended version of our interview, go to our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow, we take a look back at the apartheid era with Pamela Geen, who's turned her play The Syringa Tree into a novel. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.